Local elections are just days away in Turkey, and the outcome could result in some big political shifts. The ruling party and its influential president are keen to win back the country's big cities they lost in 2019, primarily Istanbul and Ankara. So, why do Turks take local elections as seriously as their general and presidential ones? That's our topic this week. I'm Erdem Koç.
And I'm Ozan İbrişim.
Welcome to Put Simply. Ozan, good to be back here on episode number 10 this week, discussing local elections in a country that is well known to both of us, that is Turkey, of course. And local elections in Turkey are quite interesting. But before we get to that, I'm super keen. What's caught your attention this week?
Great to be back with you, Adam. And yes, I'm looking forward to our discussion on Turkish elections. What's caught my attention this week? I've got to say, I was kind of amazed. There was a hawk that came out last week in the state of Georgia in the US. It was a CBS News poll, YouGov. And one of the things that they asked survey respondents about was about the indictments that Trump is facing in the state of Georgia. For those who may not be following or have forgotten, the state of Georgia, the Attorney General, brought down a number of indictments against Trump, mainly as a result of the phone recording that surfaced in 2021 when President Trump asked the then state secretary for about 11,700 extra votes to kind of beat Biden in the state of Georgia. On all accounts, it's quite compelling evidence that at least there was an attempt to do something quite wrong. Coming back to the survey results, when people were asked, what is your concerns or what concerns you more? 43% of people said that they're concerned because they think that the charges are politically motivated. And again, Adam, this is despite the fact that there's a phone recording that's been very publicly and widely shared. And then you've got 36% said that Trump tried to overturn the election, and 21% both equally. And the reason why this caught my attention is it just comes back to, or comes down to, what happens, I suppose, when there is a vacuum or when you leave the field to your opponents and they fill it with their own messages. And when you look at that message, 43% of people feeling that the charges are politically motivated, that is straight and directly out of President Trump's playbook and his message book. So clearly, he has spent a lot of time talking about this case. President Biden and the administration are bound by legal proceedings, so they've done the right thing and not talked about it. But what's naturally happened is a massive vacuum that's been filled with almost half of the people believing Trump is some sort of victim of a justice system or a justice department that is bringing forward some sort of political attack on him.
To me, it's PR and comms 101, right? If you don't tell your story, someone else will tell your story. And when someone else tells your story, it's not going to be the story that you are going to want out there in the field. And this, I think, is a really good example of that. The facts become irrelevant, and then it's the spin that's put on it. And I think, look, Trump is very good at getting his messages across. He has excellent people that understand messages and how they work from a communications perspective. He's a great communicator and obviously an incredibly influential politician. So there's part of that. There's part of whatever he says, there's a big portion of the population that will believe it. And this is true on both sides of politics, by the way. You know, I think the issue that we have in the world at the moment is polarization. And people will stick to not necessarily an ideology, because I think those days are sort of coming to an end, but they will stick to personalities and what those personalities in politics say, regardless of what the facts are presented to them by. And we see this in a decline in confidence in the news media, and we see this in a decline in public institutions, etc. Personalities then thrive. And this is true not only in the US, but even in Turkey, the topic of our conversation today. And you know, from a comms perspective, if you're not filling the void other people do. And to me, what caught my attention this week, and I think this theme continues, is what's happening in the UK over the Kate Middleton saga. Now, I'm going to leave out the conspiracy theories and why images were doctored and all that kind of stuff, but she's obviously is going through some health issues and has been going through some health issues for some time, hasn't really been seen in public over Christmas, and this has led to all sorts of conspiracy theories online from, you know, was she murdered by the royal family? Has her and Prince William had a divorce, or are they living separately, whatever? The thing that I think the palace has done incorrectly here, and again PR comms 101, is they haven't told the story. They haven't told us what is actually happening. And when you don't tell your story, somebody else does. And in today's world, it's Twitter, it's Facebook, it's TikTok, it's Instagram that are telling the story for you. On top of that, they make the mistake of putting out a photo pretending that Kate's with her kids, which is clearly doctored, to the point where news organizations are now no longer running that photo because it's been a manipulated image or an AI-generated image, right? Just come out and tell us what's happening. And if you can't tell us what's happening, tell us why you can't tell us. I mean, give the public something. Otherwise, everyone else makes up the story for them. That's exactly what happened, to your point, in Georgia. It's the Trump and the Trump camp that make up the story. And here we're allowing these conspiracy theories to run rampant because we're not prepared to get ahead of the story and tell the story ourselves.
And I think it's particularly relevant when it comes to figures or public figures, leaders, etc., who thrive on putting forward very emotional and in some sense conspiratorial types of messages. And let's face it, a lot of those people who responded to the survey, who kind of felt some sympathy that Trump was being victimized, probably feel victimized themselves in one way or another by the government or by the elite, other institutions. So, you know, it's particularly important that if your opposition is putting forward emotional arguments, you've got to play in that field and you've got to try and plug those holes, of course, with facts, but also I think a lot of it is around how you present those facts as well. And you've got to, I think, play in the emotional game as well. And certainly in the Georgia case, that hasn't been done, I think, properly, and we see the results. And, you know, with the Kate Middleton stuff, I think it's just something that they should have gotten control of very quickly. And I would think that we're probably going to have to wait to see the next season of The Crown to really understand what went on. But let's see.
There's a Netflix series in everything, my friend, particularly maybe even in the country that we both still call home, which is going to see millions of people head to the polls next weekend to vote in the local elections. Now, local elections in most countries may not mean that much. In Turkey, there's a couple of reasons. One, Turks take every election seriously, as our guest is about to tell us. And two, more importantly, it could result in some big shifts in the country's political landscape. Our guest this week is Dr. Emre Dorda. Emre is a corporate and public affairs consultant in Istanbul. He's also an adjunct professor at Istanbul's Boğaziçi University and serves as Secretary General of the Public Affairs Institute of Turkey. He's our guest this week as we chat all things local elections here on Put Simply. Emre, thank you so much for joining us here on Put Simply this week. Could you start by telling us a little bit about what it is that you do and introduce yourself as well, please?
Sure. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me, guys. So I'm a political scientist by background. I have always been interested in understanding and managing the complex relations between business, government, and politics, and of course, the social factors as well. So currently, I'm managing partner of Corpera, which is a corporate affairs consultancy company based in Istanbul and Brussels. We work with most multinational companies to help them navigate the complex relations, the political landscape in Turkey, trying to make sense of what's happening in Turkey and in the broader region in terms of political and economic risk analysis and how they can make better decisions for their business objectives.
Well, speaking of complexity and interesting things coming up in Turkey, Turks are heading to the polls next weekend for the local elections. Can you put simply for us, what are these elections? How are they different from the elections from last year? And why do they seem quite significant in Turkey?
Sure. It's the local elections, what we call. So there are like municipalities in towns and districts in Turkey. and the Turkish people will select who are going to manage these municipalities for the next 5 years. So this might sound a bit insignificant for outsider observers, of course, because it's local elections and it's might look like a bit unimportant compared with especially the general elections and the presidential elections. But there are some elements that make these elections important and maybe even more important than some of the general elections as well. So I will just give the headlines and maybe we can talk about it in detail as we go on our conversation. One of the key, of course, areas is that Istanbul is such an urban area, right? So it's a huge metropolitan place, and it's very important for not only for the people who live in Istanbul, but also for the entire population in Turkey, and also the central government, which is based in Ankara, to have control in Istanbul, right? So it's almost one third of Turkey's GDP, so a huge economic powerhouse of the country. And it's home to more than 15 million people. So that's one of the things that make this election important. The second thing is that if everything goes as usual, there won't be any other election for the next 4 years, which is quite unusual in Turkey, by the way. So there will be a period of non-election for the next 4 years, unless there is a constitution referendum, which is again one of the topics that the government and the opposition parties are discussing. So this is going to be a last election for the next 4 years. So these are, just the headlines of why this election is important. And of course, we can talk about this as I said in detail.
Emre, could you describe some of the parties who are competing in the upcoming elections, and I suppose where they sit from an ideological point of view, and where they stand on the different issues that the Turkish people are facing?
I mean, as you might guess, there, especially before and during the general elections, which took place last year in May, there were basically two alliances, two camps in Turkey that competed against each other. One is a National Alliance led by the opposition parties, and the other one is People Alliance led by the ruling Justice and Development Party and its nationalist ally, Nationalist Movement Party. So after the defeats of President Erdogan and victory of President Erdogan and his Nationalist Movement's ally, the opposition alliance basically shattered, right? So there were six parties led by the main opposition party, People's Republican Party and the Good Party, and some minor parties. So they were, they came together and they decided to run against Erdogan as a single candidate. By then, they lost against Erdogan in May 2023. So this time, after that general elections, National Alliance cannot hold together. So there is this People's Republican Party, which is the main opposition party in Turkey. It seems like it is the main challenger of the ruling Justice and Development Party and its nationalist ally. And there are some minor political parties, some of which are actually former Justice and Development Party members, ministers, and prime ministers. So they're also running in these local elections, but they're just minor parties. So probably with a few exceptions, they don't have a higher likelihood of winning. Coming back to the issues, I think we need to make kind of a differentiation between the metropolitan areas and also between the small towns and districts in Turkey, because in most small towns and districts, people usually vote for personality of the candidates, how they're running a campaign, their local relations, their connections with the local people, authorities, different segments of the society, so on and so forth, which is not necessarily the case in metropolitan areas such as Izmir, Istanbul, and Ankara, the three biggest towns in Turkey, because in these areas, a lot of people are going to vote according to their ideological and political beliefs, right? So in Izmir, for example, which is the western part of Turkey, it's very, very, very unlikely that a conservative party such as the Justice and Development Party will win. In Istanbul, it's a bit complicated because But there is, of course, a Kurdish population in Istanbul, a secularist liberal population, a conservative population. So there are different people who immigrated from different towns from Anatolia, from eastern part of Turkey, from Black Sea region, from middle of Anatolia. So they all have different cultural backgrounds and ideologies. That said, especially for some leading candidates of the opposition, such as Ekrem İmamoğlu in Istanbul and Mansur Yavaş in Ankara, even though they're competing against, they're running against the Justice and Development Party's mayor candidates, in people's minds, they're competing against President Erdoğan. So a lot of Turkish people will vote according to their stance against President Erdoğan. So if they're supporting President Erdoğan, if they voted for President Erdoğan, let's say, in the last presidential elections, it's very likely that they're going to vote for the candidate that he's appointed to Istanbul, Ankara, and other towns. So it's a mixture of ideology and local connections, I would say.
And Emre, would you say it's because of how influential President Erdoğan has been on Turkish politics over the last 20 years is the reason why people think of this particular election that way? Because if you contrast Turkey's local elections with local elections in most other countries in the world, people wouldn't make local elections into that much of a big deal, right? But in Turkey, is it because of the president's power influence over the last 20 years, that's how Turks vote when they head to, like I said, what would otherwise be largely insignificant in other countries?
Definitely. I mean, to start with, Turks take every single election very seriously. So the voting turnout in Turkey is always extremely high. It's always above like 80% or so. So Turks really take their votes very seriously. But, joke aside, coming back to your question, yes, I mean, the dominance of President Erdoğan in Turkish politics over the past 20 years is what makes that so important for the Turkish voters, right? I would say that still President Erdoğan is influencing that perception, still underlying that perception. I mean, he's still running campaigns in different towns of Turkey as president, right? So he's going to an eastern town of Turkey, and the next day he's in a western town of Turkey, campaigning for local candidates, supporting and promoting his candidates in these towns. So he's still a very active daily political figure, which shapes the perception of voters that this is ultimately a choice between President Erdoğan and the opposition candidates. So this is why it makes it more significant than a local election.
You've mentioned obviously some of the very strong dynamics that will shape people's vote, and that being kind of their position on President Erdoğan and the ruling party. But if we're to kind of get away from, I suppose, the personalities and look at what type of issues that are top of mind when it comes to these elections, what are some of the issues that are being run in the campaign? If you could put simply for us, what are people's thoughts on this?
Definitely. I mean, I would say that the first thing, especially in Western towns of Turkey and particularly in Istanbul, is the risk of an earthquake, right? So the tragic earthquakes that took place in Turkey in February last year in 2023 was a big shock for the entire population. And it reminded every single person in this country, and especially people who live in Istanbul, including myself, the importance of having a safe and a earthquake resilient town. That being said, it's very difficult, of course, because millions of people are living here. There is an urbanization issues and traffic and of course water pollution and that kind of stuff. But this urban regeneration and making Istanbul and other Western towns earthquake resilient is one of the most important issues that people, I hope, are keeping mind when they're going to vote for any candidate. The second thing is obviously the current economic situation. There is a inflation that is about 60% in Turkey. The middle class is facing a lot of problems. The lower socioeconomic classes are really started to feel in the heat of the inflation and also the increasing cost of living. This economic issues are also important. The third thing is probably, the social polarization. right? So there is always, and sometimes even more, increasing polarization between the secularist segments of the society and the more conservative and maybe Islamist parts of the society. So these three topics, these three issues are likely to be on the mind of voters when they're going to vote by the end of March.
Let's look at the economy, Emre, because you mentioned it there. We've seen headlines all around the world. The Turkish lira has continued its plunge throughout 2024 against the US dollar. Inflation is high. You mentioned cost of living pressures, etc. Yet the Turkish Statistical Institute announced last week that the economy grew 4.5% year on year. Can you put simply for us, economically speaking, what is actually happening in the country?
I think one of the first things to keep in mind is that since Turkey is such a big population, Turkey keeps growing no matter what happens, right? So it usually grows usually at around like 3-4% unless a big shock is taking place. And what happened last year is, I think, was one of the most unusual monetary policies that the world has experienced. Before the general elections in May 2023, Turkish government and President Erdogan decided to lower the interest rates to back to 8.5%. And that really created a lot of currency volatility and also a huge increase in the inflation. That being said, the government started kind of subsidizing, especially the lower socioeconomic classes, so the retired people and the minimum wage earners. So there has been increases in minimum wage gradually, and there were some subsidies to retired people. So the government was able to keep them going despite increasing inflation. Right after the elections, with the appointment of the new Minister of Treasury and Finance, and a new management in the central bank, Turkey went back to what is now called a rational and orthodox policies to keep inflation back in, to decrease inflation back to single digits, which according to some forecasts will take place many years, at least like, 3-4 years according to the forecasts. But still, there seems to be a dedication and commitment to decrease the inflation. And the Minister of Finance and Treasury, Mehmet Şimşek, who is also a well-known international economist, is very, very insistent not to give any concession regarding that point. So, how Turkey has grown so much despite the increasing currency, depreciating Turkish lira, and increasing inflation is that a lot of people, including myself and my family, decided to make their purchases and shopping as soon as possible because you are constantly making the assumption that things will get worse and the prices are going to increase in the near future. So the sooner I buy it, the better. And that, of course, if you look at the breakdown of the Turkish GDP growth, influences how that growth is happening, which is mostly based on private consumption. So now, to achieve the goal of decreasing inflation, the government is taking even more stricter disinflationary measures, such as putting limits on credit cards or loan growth. So, limiting the money supply in the markets is what this government is doing currently. And I think, a lot of people will see a very sharp decrease in their disposable income in the near future.
Coming back to the election, in your opinion, has anything changed since last year's presidential election, where we saw two rounds, and it was compared to previous elections, one could argue a pretty close election result. Have you seen anything that's substantially changed in terms of the support of the ruling President Erdogan's party and the opposition party that would impact the election results for the upcoming election?
Well, I think the main change was in the mindset of people, because after the general elections, in which President Erdogan had another victory, a lot of people get convinced that, okay, I mean, this is not changing, especially the opposition voters understood that, okay, there is no going back to the previous parliamentary system, because that was one of the promises of the opposition camp, right? So if they win the elections, we're going to terminate this presidential system, which Turkey transitioned in 2017. We're going to go back to the parliamentary system. That was one of the main election promises of the opposition camp. And since Erdogan won, that was not possible. So a lot of people said, okay, this is not going to change. Presidential system will continue. And Erdogan will remain in power until 2028. So most of the population segments have changed their calculations and their positioning, right? So now we are seeing that different political parties are making different negotiations with each other, because obviously there is another 4 or 5 years for President Erdogan and his allies to rule the country. So that's the main change, I would say. The second thing is that, as I said, the breakdown of the opposition camp. So there were two main political parties supported by four minor parties in that National Alliance. So the People's Republican Party, CHP, and Good Party, EE Party, were the two main allies in the National Alliance, or the so-called the Table of Six, and it broke down basically. So there is no alliance between these two main opposition parties anymore. And that, of course, is going to be one of the main drivers of how people are going to vote in the upcoming elections. And the third thing is the U-turn in economic policies, which I just mentioned.
We spoke earlier about the popularity and influence of President Erdogan, and also personalities in politics. One other individual from the opposition camp who has been quite influential and a big personality is the current mayor of Istanbul, Ekrem İmamoğlu, who had an incredible victory in the last election. Obviously, Istanbul is a key city for Turkey, and President Erdogan and the ruling Justice and Development Party will want to take it back. In terms of big personalities and political figures, what do you think of İmamoğlu's future? If he wins Istanbul again this time round, does he have the popularity and the charisma and the influence on the Turkish people, which could potentially see him be a presidential candidate next time round against whoever the presidential candidate is from the Justice and Development Party side? Does he have enough of momentum and sway over people, do you think?
In short, yes. I mean, I do think that if he wins Istanbul once again, he's going to be one of the most influential figures in Turkish politics for the next probably 1 or 2 decades. Why is this so? It's because President Erdogan is such a powerful figure in Turkish politics that he has not been defeated up until Ekrem İmamoğlu won the Istanbul municipal elections back in 2019. And there was a rerun of the election and he won again, even with a bigger margin. So if he wins again this time, he's going to be the only political figure in Turkey who will be have consistently won against Erdogan in consecutive elections. So that's a big thing. There is also a kind of traditional cultural part of this, is that President Erdogan, as you know, he's also former mayor of Istanbul. His political career started in Istanbul. He was mayor of Istanbul between 1994 and 1999. There is the saying in Turkey is that whoever rules Istanbul rules Turkey. As someone who has the ability to rule Istanbul, and of course, who commands such a big economic zone in Turkey, Ekrem İmamoğlu, it will definitely be one of the most dominant and influential figures in Turkish politics. And from a personality perspective, I think he's quite similar to Erdogan's personality, being able to connect with ordinary people, coming from the Black Sea region of Turkey, having the ability to manage big and complex issues such as the infrastructure problem of Istanbul, other problems that big metropolitan areas are facing. And we have seen, just to make an addition to that point, we have seen, especially since the elections in May, as the chairman of People's Republican Party was ousted in the Congress, and there is a new chairman, and who is obviously supported by Ekrem İmamoğlu. And since then, since the replacement of the chairman of his political party, we are seeing an immense increase of influence by Ekrem İmamoğlu in People's Republican Party. So I think he's slowly but surely establishing himself in the political party, and thus in the broader Turkish political sphere.
Emre, we love talking about opinion research and polling on Put Simply. Could you tell us what the polls are saying for the upcoming election? who is likely to win according to the polls in obviously the big cities, and how reliable are polls? For example, did the pollsters get it right in the last year's presidential election?
Let me start from your second question. In the last elections, most of them failed, and especially some reputable and well-known pollsters. They were predicting that the opposition candidate Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu was going to win by, you know, 1 or 2% in the first, especially in the first round, but that didn't take place. And I know for the fact that most of the opposition politicians were very much convinced about, you know, a certain victory in the first round. So the pollsters in Turkey can get things wrong in big elections. So when it comes to this local elections, is that obviously in Ankara, the mayor of Ankara is a political figure, Mansur Yavaş, who can appeal to different segments of the society. He also comes from a nationalist background, but the way that he manages, he governs, does not disturb at least the liberal and secular middle-class people. So it seems like he has a very, very high likelihood of winning in Ankara. İzmir is, you know, is a no-brainer, basically. There is no way that Justice and Development Party, a conservative and Islamist-oriented candidate, is going to win the majority of the votes in Izmir, because people are usually, I mean, even though it's a, you know, local election, especially the people, the voters in Izmir, they usually and mostly vote for ideological reasons. Which brings us back to the question of Istanbul, obviously. So I have been checking some of the reputable pollsters' results, which shows that the current mayor of Istanbul, who is the candidate of the opposition People's Republican Party, it seems like he is ahead by 3-4% for the moment. The Justice and Development Party's candidate, Murat Kurum, he is actually an executive figure. You know, he was working for, you know, Turkish construction institution, and then he served as the Minister of Urbanization and Environment. But he is not a street politician like Ekrem İmamoğlu, I would say. You know, he was a performer, he was a manager, he was an executive who was appointed to the posts by President Erdogan rather than being elected by popular vote. So when I look at their political campaigns, I can clearly see the difference. Whereas Ekrem İmamoğlu, you know, being using the advantage of being the existing mayor, he's taking the benefit of, you know, trying to demonstrate what he has done so far and his achievements in terms of infrastructure developments and other things. Whereas his contender Murat Kurum, since he's not as I said, elected politician, he's facing difficulties in conveying his messages to the wider population. That being said, you know, nothing should be taken for granted in Turkish politics, because we know for the fact that President Erdogan is going to focus on Istanbul in the coming weeks and days to get more votes from his constituents. Interestingly, last week, he said that this is going to be his final election, because according to the constitution, he cannot be reelected unless the parliament decides otherwise. So he said that, and, you know, a lot of people thought that, okay, this is another emotional appeal to the Turkish voters to get support for his candidate in Istanbul. So as I said, you know, there is just, you know, 2-3%, 4% of difference between the candidates. There is an unknown factor, which is the Kurdish voters. In the previous election, Kurds decided to support Ekrem İmamoğlu in 2019. They decided to support Ekrem İmamoğlu and they voted for him. And it was a big support for İmamoğlu to win Istanbul. But this time, they have their own candidates. So she's a quite popular Kurdish political figure, right? So if Kurdish voters are going to vote for her, if she gets around like 7-9% of the votes in Istanbul, then it's going to be quite difficult for İmamoğlu to get elected.
We might just change direction and talk a little bit about foreign policy now. And obviously, Turkey, as a prominent NATO member, has made significant headlines with President Erdogan consistently calling for a ceasefire, being quite strongly critical of the Israeli government and Prime Minister Netanyahu for its actions in Gaza. And I would say it would be fair to characterize that Turkey is considered largely out of step with the rest of its NATO counterparts. To add to this, we saw that Turkey was proved to be quite difficult during the recent Swedish membership process that it went through to join NATO. Do you think Turkey's relationship with the West is strained in general terms today?
I would agree with you that, you know, Turkey had a difficult relationship, especially with the West and particularly with the United States over the past few years. But there are some very recent early indicators of that relations being changed, especially since a couple of weeks. So one of the main reasons, obviously, that Turkey had a strained relationship with the West was Turkey's rapprochement, especially to Russia, right? And Turkey's purchase of S-400 missile defense systems from Russia, which was very much against the NATO principles. So there was this big confrontation between NATO members and especially with the United States and between Turkey about Turkey purchasing air missile defense systems. So now Turkey justified that purchase by saying that, you know, we wanted to buy the Patriots, but we couldn't buy them. So we had to, you know, in order to improve our air defense, we had to buy it from Russia. But obviously that creates a misalignment with NATO principles, right? So in exchange of that, Turkey was expelled from F-35 fighter jet program. Turkey was a part of that, one of the producer countries, and was going to acquire and receive some of these fighter jets, but wasn't expelled from that program. So after that, the Turkish government and President Erdogan said that, you know, we are not going to allow the Swedish government to become a part of NATO. As you know, NATO votes are unanimous. So Turkey said that, you know, we're not going to allow this. And it seems like there was some back channel negotiations between the two countries. And in exchange of the approval by the Congress to sell Turkey F-16 fighter jets, Turkey approved Sweden's membership of NATO. Still, as I understand, you know, based on the public available information, Turkey is eager to buy F-35 fighter jets because there are like fifth generation of fighter jets, which are more sophisticated, obviously. But that seems to be a difficult target for the Turkish government. That being said, you know, coming back to my earlier comment about, you know, this, you know, relationship being restructured and, you know, the early signs of improvement between the two sides is that the Turkish foreign minister and the head of national intelligence were in DC a couple of weeks ago making some negotiations with the US administration. And right after that, we are seeing some political changes in the Turkish government, especially with regards to Iraq. Now, why is it important? It's important because Iraq, especially northern Iraq, is the home base of terrorist group PKK, which is fighting against Turkish Turkish state for the past 30 years. Now, it seems like there is a grand bargain between Turkey and the central Iraqi government against expelling all these terrorist organizations from northern Iraq and also probably some part of Syria to create a safe zone between those borders, which is going to be coupled by improving some infrastructure and the trade relations. So these are all seem to be a part of the same comprehensive foreign policy framework to me. On the one hand, Turkey is trying to improve its relations with the United States. On the other hand, it's for the first time in 12 years, President Erdogan is going to visit Baghdad to help hold negotiations with the Iraqi government. So it seems like there is a new changes in the broader region in Turkey, and it's also related to Turkey's relations with the United States. That's how I see it for the moment, but of course, that's a hypothesis, and we should be observing other indicators to validate that.
And if 24 hours is a long time in politics anywhere else in the world, 1 hour in Turkey can change the entire dynamic, as we know. Emre, before we go, let's get your projections for the results of the upcoming elections. What do you think will happen overall, particularly in the big cities, namely Istanbul and Ankara, that we've spoken about?
So because of the economic conditions, there might be a slight decrease in the overall average vote of the Justice and Development Party. But of course, as you said, what matters is what happens in Istanbul and Ankara. I do really think that Ankara is, you know, is the mayor of Ankara will be re-elected, Mansur Yavaş. When it comes to Istanbul, it's a close call, but I will take the risk and say that there is a likelihood that the ruling party's candidate Murat Kurum might win by a slight difference, especially if Kurds vote for their own political party and the minor political parties, especially conservative parties, are supporting the ruling Justice and Development Party's candidate.
Fantastic. It's been a very informative and interesting discussion, Emre. We thank you for your time, and let's see what happens in a couple of weeks.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thanks for having me, and I'm equally excited to observe what's going to happen in the near future.
And that's been this week's episode of Put Simply. Be sure to follow us on LinkedIn at Oroka Group to stay up to date with all the latest episodes and news. Feel free to leave a comment and suggestions on what you'd like to see featured on the podcast as well. Until next time, I'm Erdem Koç.
And I'm Ozan Ibrahim.
Thanks for listening.